Hello, good afternoon and welcome to Tate Modern. My name's George Clark. I'm one of the curators of film here. And it's great to see so many of you here on a sunny afternoon. There'll be many more sunny Sunday afternoons, I'm sure, but there won't be many more afternoons like this, so you've made the right choice today. This is a very special day, coming in the midst of our ongoing retrospective, LA Rebellion, Creating a New Black Cinema. And we're really thrilled to have various of the special guests here today to share their experience and also to kind of reflect on what is a rich, complex, multifaceted period, history, body of work, and a diverse range of concerns. All of the work that we'll be showing over the next few weekends stems from the pioneering film and television school at UCLA. After kind of emerged out of a very particular context, political history, and also a series of social concerns following the uprising in Watts in the mid-60s, UCLA developed an initiative to expand the film school and provide a broader range of opportunities for diverse communities across Los Angeles, but also across the US and internationally. And the school was really set up to encourage and provide a route into the film industry, into the creative industry, for a diverse student body made up of African Americans, Asian Americans, Latino, and also Native American students. And from that history, from that period, and the works that were made there, one of the strongest kind of bodies or groups of work that we're exploring over the next few weeks are the films made by African and African American directors that really took advantage of the opportunities, the context, the climate, the social, political history, and also the kind of critical context of the school to create what really stands as one of the most remarkable and sustained bodies of work and attempts to create and propose an alternative cinema, an alternative black cinema. And we're thrilled that today we're going to really kind of dig in to what that could mean, what the kind of origins of that were, the kind of social context, the relationship between the visual arts, music, philosophy, theory, politics, and cinema, to kind of excavate where this phenomena, this group of filmmakers emerged. And as such, we'll be showing various films throughout the day and various early films made by many of the kind of key participants within the LA Rebellion group. Just to give you a sense of how the day will work, we've kind of been broken up into three sessions. The first session will take us to about 3:15, where we'll have a tea break. Then we'll have another session that'll take us to around 5 o'clock. And then the final session at 5:30 is a screening of Barbara McCullough's Shopping Bag, Spirits and Freeway Fetishes. And if you have a ticket for the seminar, you have a ticket for the whole day. So please stay around for that. And before I introduce our first speakers, I'll just give you a little sense as well of kind of how the day will be, sessions will be structured, the two sessions now. We'll be showing a series of films, two films in each section, to kind of illustrate and give a sense of what it was like at the school at that time. And we're very pleased to have a range of speakers. Unfortunately, one of the speakers, the academic film historian and one of the curators behind the restoration project at UCLA, Jacqueline Stewart, is not able to be here due to illness within in her family, but she sends her regards to you all, and she's here in spirit and very much here in the films that she was one of the key people to help resurrect and bring back to present that we can share with you today. The session is developed in collaboration with the Otterworth Collective, which is the structure to facilitate the curatorial project of the artists, curators, and writers Koja Eshin and Angelika Segar. It's a group, a structure that kind of complements their art practice and is a way to frame, build discussions, and present diverse film practices and kind of excavate different histories. And their work has been a key presence to advocate and to explore, remap particular histories stemming from their pioneering exhibition of the Black Audio Collective to various projects that have happened here at Tate Modern, including a retrospective of the films of Haron Faruqi, who's maybe a spiritual cousin of some of the works we'll be seeing throughout this season. Then after Kojo and Anjali, we'll be joined by Barbara McCullough, one of the key key figures and key discoveries for me really within this whole project. She's a remarkable filmmaker and artist, remarkable for the way that she bridges and draws together a diverse range of concerns from music, performance, feminism, different modes of representation and experimental practice. And we're really thrilled to have her here to share her pioneering work, Water Ritual, but also her essay film later this evening. She'll be discussing her practice throughout the day. After the presentation by Barbara, we'll be joined by June Giovanni, a key figure in the UK who's been a phenomenal force and presence for over 30 years, advocating, screening, writing about, helping to distribute many of these films that she was kind of behind showing them in the UK for the first time, and also crucially building connections between filmmakers across America, Africa, Latin America, and broader parts of the world, and she'll do a special presentation drawing on her remarkable archive, the June Giovanni Pan-African Film Archive, and various of the remarkable material she's amassed through that, and kind of trace some of the connections, the linkages, discussions, and conversations that these films have inspired and also crucially been part of. June will then take us to the break, and then we're very pleased that Billy Woodbury, who was with us last night for his screening of his film, Bless Their Little Hearts, will then join us for a panel discussion. And we're very pleased that many artists, filmmakers and programmers are here in the audience, and we really look forward to drawing out your input and your questions, comments, reflections on this period in these films in that session. So that's probably enough for me as a kind of preamble. So please join me now in welcoming our first speakers, Kojo Esh and Angelica Segar.
Okay, it's great to see so many people here on a Sunday afternoon. This is something, a text we prepared especially for this afternoon. I'm sure everybody here is aware of the Black Lives Matter hashtag, and I'm sure everybody's here is aware of the campaigns in the US, and I'm sure everybody is aware of the recent shooting of Walter Scott by the policeman, Michael Sager. And this is a text which responds to that in relation to the films that we're lucky enough to see after waiting to see them for many years. Is it not self-evident that black lives matter?
That saying that black lives matters
goes without saying.
That it is necessary
but not sufficient
to state that what matters
is that black lives matter.
That what matters now
more than ever
is that black lives are seen to matter.
To state that black lives matter
is to presuppose a time
in which black lives did not.
A time when the border
between the lives that mattered
and the lives that did not
mattered to those trying
to dissolve the border by crossing
from the latter to the former,
and those seeking to maintain the border
by moving with it as they tracked
and targeted
and logged
and accounted.
When was this time?
This time was now.
In this time when what matters
does not yet matter,
is it not a question
of matter out of place?
Is the matter of seeing in which ways
black lives are
seen to matter
not a matter of
seeing in which precise ways
and with what methods
and from what perspectives
and with what frames
and with what words
and with what musics
and with what figures
scenes of black lives and
scenes from black lives
and lives of black scenes
can be made to matter?
Is it not a matter of inventing ways for cinematters to matter?
Any image and any sound can be a cinematter.
A formatter.
Any format can matter.
Any format can be a formatter.
Could be.
Might be.
So long as it's a matter of concern.
It has to be a matter
that matters to
those that it draws towards it.
Does it not go without saying that
seeing scenes from black lives
is a matter of
inventing ways of hearing
in which ways
precisely
cinematters continue to matter?
Is it not a matter of listening
into the ways in which a cinema
that remains
to this day
largely unheard,
unseen,
unsuspected
by audiences
here in London
remains
in ways yet to be understood?
A cinema that is yet to be understood.
A cinema that has not yet been metabolized.
Is a cinema that has not yet
entered the internal constitution of this country.
Is this not a cinema that lies ahead of its audience?
A cinema whose demands are yet to be answered.
An unfinished cinema.
Whose questions are sustained.
Into the present.
Moment.
As an encounter.
With the unresolved capacity to compose images and sounds.
That interfere with events.
That modify reality.
Is it not a question of listening?
To the ways in which.
This cinema.
Listens to its scenes of subjection.
Its deserts of the political.
The ruins of its Goodyear factory.
For block after block.
The abandoned area of Watts.
That had been cleared to make way for the
105 freeway.
In Barbara McCulloch's Water Ritual Number 1, an urban rite of purification.
Its abandoned rail yards.
In McCulloch's Shopping Bag Spirit and Freeway Fetishes, Reflections on Ritual Space.
Senga Nengudi can be seen performing Ceremony for Freeway Fets.
Her first full-length performance.
Under a deserted section of the freeway near to the Los Angeles Convention Center.
In the southwest area of downtown Los Angeles.
In which there were little tiny palm trees and a lot of dirt.
Because it was under the freeway, it was kind of cloistered in a sense.
You could have this rural atmosphere in the midst of an urban setting.
Barbara McCulloch punctuates Shopping Bag Spirits and Freeway Fetishes, Reflections on Ritual Space, with edited passages from Don Cherry's Chinrezig from the album Brown Rice, and Eagle Eye and Surrender Rose from the album Here From Now.
For the artists and musicians in America and Europe, Cherry played the role of a barefoot John Cage.
A permissive figure whose synthesis of folk forms into universal folklore
paralleled the urban ritualism
valorized by Senga Nengudi,
David Hammonds,
Betty Saar,
Kinshasa Conwell,
Houston Conwell,
and Barbara McCullough.
To enter into the desert of the political
is to come face to face with defeatism
and there to invent rituals that connect to the outside.
To cosmic forces.
Forces that children can summon.
In these films,
scenes of children
tested in the street battles
of safe wars,
wearied from tournaments in rail yards,
mercilessly subjecting each other
to ceaseless torments
and interminable teasing
of boys that cry,
the face of the boy at the conclusion of Bless Their Little Hearts,
defenseless before a vision of everyday reality that is unbearable, as Tom Anderson writes,
stricken with internal anguish at the thought of the
void that waits to swallow him,
the face of the boy in the second beginning of Killer of Sheep.
You will recall that Killer of Sheep starts twice.
The first time in darkness.
With voices.
Singing.
Paul Robeson.
Which fades out to begin again.
A boy standing as his father berates him.
Prepares him for a future violence.
With preemptive threats.
In these films, scenes of women.
Intimate with disappointment.
The architecture of their knees folded.
Under patterned dresses.
Preparing themselves for a ritual known only to them.
In these films, certain actresses are muses.
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 Casey Moore in Killer of Sheep.
Preparing her face.
With precise and ruthless gestures.
Patting down her dress at the mirror.
Appraising her sleeves.
Her arms.
Her shoulders.
Her neckline.
Her waist.
Kneading her temples.
Pressing her forehead.
After the bus ride home from work in Bless Their Little Hearts.
As weary as a worker returning to Soweto in a David Goldblatt photograph.
Casey Moore as the senior daughter in Daughters of the Dust.
Dutiful, serious, frowning.
Barbara O. Jones in Child of Resistance.
She is an internal colony.
She is not an actor but a seer, as Tom Anderson writes.
She is a factory producing psychic desires. Personified in a burlesque that is part Fanonian and part Fellini-esque.
A parade of pop art poses and postures.
In which characters lift glasses of whiskey with the weary gravitas of immortals or superheroes.
Unable to remember the details of the death they long for.
In Bush Mama.
Jones is Dorothy. Defenseless before a vision of everyday reality that is unbearable.
Staring at the poster of the female MPLA revolutionary. She measures the distance between
the time of the revolutionary
and her own time, which is occupied.
Can she steal back her body and run away from herself?
These films, they're scenes of men subjected to masculinity.
Whose compulsions baffle them and
whose consolations humiliate them.
These films, they're scenes of those unused to being listened to.
And unused to being recorded as they are being listened to.
It is a matter
of conceiving the present
as the unfinished histories of
transient and vulnerable beings
of unsheltered lives.
Of the care for images.
That travel between bodies injured by images and demeaned by cinema.
It is a matter of entunement.
Of resounding cinema into
epiphanies informed by musics that intimates the possible forms of a new cinema.
Julie Dash's Four Women
begins with the unspecified African chants.
The sound of whips.
The sound of water.
Of splashing.
Of waves.
Constitute an audio montage of slavery
that condenses centuries into minutes.
Nina Simone described Four Women from 1966
as a picture of four different women, Negro women,
each of which has a different colour.
The frustrations that bear down upon the figures of Aunt Sarah,
Sophronia,
Sweet Thing,
Peaches,
are personified in the costume changes,
the hair,
the makeup,
lighting and
the gestural language of dancer Linda Martina Young
that mimes
the choreography
of the uncumbered lives
of four American women,
four American saints of the stockyards.
In Medea,
the majesty of clouds
gives way to a rapid eye montage of archival images
that compresses centuries into minutes,
treating a vast range of illustrations as
a vision of rhythm that accelerates into a presence
that is narrated by an unknown voice,
in which
the sun's rays
raise the race
into a cosmic
relationship
with the solar economy.
It is a matter of shock to thought,
of a cinema that was conceived and invented
by a number of directors
over a number of years
at a certain time
in
certain areas of Los Angeles.
A cinema that was planned
and projected
and planned and projected,
analysed
and discussed
and discussed and analysed and debated
and critiqued and debated
and recorded and critiqued
and acted
and invented
and edited
and composed and scored.
It is a matter of a cinema that listens into scenes from black lives
in order to make the scenes into theoreticians,
as Marx would say,
so as to begin to formulate
in which senses
and in which ways
what is visible differs
from what is obvious,
so as to sensitise yourself to the ways in
which what is visible
distinguishes itself
from what is evident,
from inattention,
from what goes without saying,
from what passes below attention.
It is a matter of observing against the grain of the habitual,
seeing against all the evidence,
against blind spots.
To think cinematically is to draw attention to the
infamous and the anonymous,
and to create an encounter with mortality.
Saturday morning,
4th April 2015.
An execution is about to take place.
It is approximately 9:35 a.m.
North Charleston, South Carolina police officer Michael Slager's patrol car begins to stop Walter Scott at the intersection of Remount Road and Craig Road.
Slager radios the dispatcher to say he was, quote, coming up on a grey Mercedes, close quote.
The camera on the dashboard of Slager's patrol car records Walter Scott as he opens the driver's door of his Mercedes-Benz.
From the fixed perspective of the dash cam, Scott runs left out of frame.
The dash cam records the audio.
Out of the view of the dash cam, Slager chases Scott on foot.
Before he started filming, bystander Fadin Santana said that it looked as though Scott and Slager had briefly struggled on the ground.
They were down on the floor before I started recording, he said.
Santana said Scott never grabbed the taser of the police.
Fadin Santana shoots the mobile phone video footage of North Carolina, North Charleston, South Carolina, police officer Michael Slager shooting Walter Scott 8 times as he runs.
5 bullets hit Scott.
The Guardian, 9th April 2015. In the video, Santana does not interact with Slager or his partner.
Santana matters abuse as he approaches the prone body of Walter Scott, where 2 officers hover.
They apparently ignore him, although Santana says one of the officers told him to, quote, just move from there.
Earlier in the video, but after Slager shot Scott, Slager appears to run and look directly at Santana.
Just 3 seconds later, at 9:38 a.m., almost 5 minutes after Slager announced that he was stopping Scott in his car, Slager was back on the radio.
223 shots fired, he said. Subject is down. He grabbed my taser.
I recorded the video, so maybe that he felt that he can feel that someone is there, Santana said. It was an empty spot. There were just the 3 of us in that moment.
I couldn't tell what was going to happen, so I just wanted him to know that he's not by himself.
Could Walter Scott feel that he could feel that someone was there.
Did he know that he was not alone as he died from 5 bullets?
That Fadin Santana wanted him to know that he was not alone.
That he was not alone on this bitter earth.
This sweet earth flying. Thanks. Thank you.
So please join me now in welcoming Barbara McCullough, who'll have a brief conversation with Kojo and then present her film Water Ritual. So please welcome Barbara McCullough.
Barbara, welcome to London. I know you've been here for a few days now, mm-hmm. and you've been watching the films and you know, revisiting films that were part of your milieu and part of your world as a student at the School of Film, Television and Theatre at UCLA.
You know, it's really interesting because that was the first time I'd seen Hailey's, this particular film of Hailey's, and I'm going like, now I understand his evolution, you know, which is really, really interesting to see.
In what way? Tell me a bit about that.
You know, Hailey is a very, very strong filmmaker. His images and his messages are very strong. Okay, and I think this might have been one of his first films.
Yeah.
Okay, so he never deviated from his path. You know, he they pretty much was pretty consistent in terms of the messages that he wanted to convey in his films.
Yeah. So as far as I understand, UCLA had this this system of the Project One film, mm-hmm. so that in your first year you would be thrown at the deep end and you would have to make a film.
Yes.
And they call them Project One.
Exactly.
It's like a first year film. So in a sense, you're making a film before you have the, you know, before you have the capacities to do it, and you learn it through making.
Exactly.
And maybe you could give us a sense before we go to Water Ritual. I mean, it's clear that obviously many people here won't have seen it, but maybe you could give us a sense of your entry into the UCLA system, how you found your way into the school, and your entry into the film world.
I was originally interested in dance at UCLA and also in photography. And I was an undergraduate and I was taking some video classes. It was a community video class that was operated by a professor who was a filmmaker and one who was an anthropologist. And I really wanted to, you know, do an independent major. Basically, that would include what I was already taking, which was communication studies, okay? But also, I wanted to include things like photography and also video. And at that time, it was like reel-to-reel black, you know, black and white video.
What year is this?
This was, oh my goodness. I must have been about 74, 5, something like that, 74, 5, 75. And so what happened was, instead of my having one more year, you know, as an undergraduate, I wound up having 2 more years as an undergraduate, which was like the ultimate bummer for me because I had no intentions of, you know, prolonging my academic career as an undergraduate in that way. But anyway, so I took this video class, and it was ethnographic video. And what these professors wanted you to do was visit Topanga Canyon because they had this trailer, this old trailer that they operated, this community television station. And they wanted you to, you know, take a look at some aspect of life in Topanga Canyon. And so, you know, they just, you know, let you go. You know, they said, well, there's these people here and there's these people here. You might want to check them out. And I checked out this couple with a young baby who were pregnant with twins. We're living in a trailer in Topanga Canyon. And he was an experimental filmmaker who used to paint on film. Okay, and he was sort of handicapped because of the fact that he had gotten poison ivy in his eyes, and so he couldn't really function very well. But so what I wound up doing was just following his family, you know, and I shot a small piece, but it was very, very, it was very rewarding because I got a sense to test out my vision in terms of the things that I saw. And as a result, this particular professor said, well, you know, I really like your eye. Had you ever thought about film school? And I said, yeah, but I really sort of thought it was like beyond my reach in terms of, you know, entering film school. I mean, I was interested in history. I was interested in, you know, life in the rural South. Okay, I was very much influenced by Zora Neale Hurston and her writings and her adventures, and I was interested in becoming the Zora Neale Hurston of the 21st century, you know, and I was really, you know, so impressed with the way that her stories could, you know, depict the language, you know, of the people of rural Florida, and also give you these visual images that were really, you know, very, very revealing in terms of where, you know, African Americans came from. Okay, so even though you may have been thrust into an urban environment, you still had these roots way back, you know, in a, let's say, small southern towns. A lot of people did, you know. So anyway, so I went from that, and I entered film school, and which was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, what project am I going to do? You know, what's going to be the subject matter of a project? And I was like going all over the place, you know, should I do this and should I do that? And everything seemed to be so pretentious because it was outside of my realm of understanding. So someone just said, well, why don't you just do a film on something that you know something about? Okay. And so my first film was called Sefren Kafra, 2 Years of a Dynasty. And essentially it was about my son who had, you know, just turned 2. And so when I screened the film, you know, well, first of all, it was a task because, you know, I filmed it within the confines of my family. So I had a big brother who was turned off completely, a big sister who thought this was totally completely ridiculous, and this kid running around basically, you know, all over the place, not really feeling like, you know, he wanted to be a part of this. And so I was able to, you know, basically shoot segments of it that I wound up having some very, very magical things of him and also photographs that I had taken. So when I screened it, you know, everybody gets to screen their films, and it's the most terrifying experience you can ever have. It's screening your first film at UCLA in an audience that's probably about, oh, 4 or 5 times the size of this audience, and you're supposed to sit there with this basic lack of knowledge in terms of, you know, making films and being able to present, and I'll say defend, because that's what you felt like. It was like you were defending, okay, the fact that you would want to even make a film about something in your family. So, you know, one of the faculty members said, well, it looks like a combination of maybe home movies and enlightened cinema. And I'm going like, oh God, let me just hang on to the enlightened cinema part of it, you know, because it was a terrifying experience. Afterwards, you know, I left, I went to my car and I cried. Because to expose yourself in that way, you know, not necessarily identifying where you were going to go within the confines of that experience, it was, you know, it was very, very devastating. And I came to it, you know, I'd already had kids, you know, and here I am going to film school, you know, in a situation where you had no financial support. You had, you know, your scholarships for your, you know, tuition. You had no money for film. You had no money for videotape. You had no money for processing. Okay, what you did have was people around you who, you know, they wound up being your collaborators. They wound up being your support folks, and that's how you were able to like get through the experience because everybody had entered it pretty much the same way. There were a few people like Julie who had film experience. Okay, and Shanalila Larkin was already there. But what was really so intense was the fact that, okay, Billy was still there, Charles was leaving, Holly was gone, Ben Colway was hanging out, he was still kind of there. But most of the, you know, the male filmmakers who were like the potential mentors were like either gone or leaving. So all of a sudden, you know, what UCLA had done is that you felt like you were like this double minority. So you had an exodus of the men and you had an influx of women filmmakers. So all of a sudden it was like, oh, you know, and you didn't even think about it at that time. You just think about, oh, I know Julie's gonna be here and Carol's gonna be here. And, you know, so that was kind of like your grounding, you know, because you know that there may be people out there who were still left that you could communicate with and who had, you know, Carol had a very well-developed eye because she was a still photographer and Julie's work, you know, was strong. She'd gone to AFI, she'd had film experience. So, you knew she was there. But still, you were in many ways, you know, on your own, even though there was that support here and there, you were basically on your own. And you were trying to figure out, you know, like, what do I do next? What do I need to learn? And the system at UCLA I thought was really beneficial for people who wanted to be independent filmmakers because you got exposure to the full realm of, you know, what I call the pipeline, okay? The pipeline of filmmaking, you know, where things started, you know, how it evolved, the different components that were involved in it, you know, the marriage of sound and images. You know, the first film that you did, which is Project One, was like no sync dialogue. So basically it was music, okay? And so you are trying to figure out, you know, am I, you know, where am I going, you know, with this? And it was, you know, it was a very taxing experience, you know. Trying to recognize, you know, what can I do? You know, how can I explain my world to the world, to the outer world, okay? And how I can utilize what I feel and then convey that in a visual way is one of the tasks that I felt that I was, you know, trying to address.
So, so there we have you, a kind of a neophyte filmmaker struggling to develop a film language. And the film we're about to see, Water Ritual Number One, An Urban Rite of Purification, has this compression and this confidence. So is there anything you'd like to kind of say by way of an introduction before we go into it? Because, you know, the things you're saying, the anxieties that you expressed, I think all young filmmakers experience this, the sense of hazard and risk.
But, terror.
Yeah, sheer blind terror. You know, the terror of which film, which shot should follow the next shot, you know, how to make this. What, there's a time when there is nothing, there's just an idea. How to nurture this idea until it becomes a reality. This is the terror of creating something. And yet the film we're about to see has a very specific film language, which is very different from the, let's say, the more masculinist perspective of Haile Gerima, you know, slightly earlier generation. So maybe by way of introduction, before we go into it, is there anything you'd like to say to the audience about Water Ritual?
Water Ritual started off as a camera exercise, and it was a camera exercise that went wrong because I had an ARRI camera, and you would set to 24 frames per second, and it slipped to 18 frames per second. So all of a sudden, this very naturalistic movement became very staccato, very, you know, very much like, you know, the old Charlie Chaplin movies before they figured out how to basically slow you to speed it up to the correct, you know, frames per second. But anyway, so it had to be done again, okay? And that was really, really a challenge. And I worked with Yolanda, you know, Vitito, because I knew her. We were friends. And we were also grasping for trying to find out, you know, who we were as creative people, who we were as women, you know, what was our place in terms of expressing that, okay? And so my form of expression was a little bit more subtle, let's say like maybe Haile's. And so I wanted to do something that was going to be in a way spontaneous, but at the same time, you know, a cathartic experience. So, you know, we went to this location, which was 109th in Maine. And it was deserted, and there was like when the leftovers from when the freeway was going to be built. And, you know, so all of a sudden you had this terrain that was, you know, without houses, without anything other than some specks here, you know, left of debris from where houses stood. And it was like really interesting because there were, you know, glass on the ground, and the glass reflected the sun, and all of a sudden, the glass on the ground looked jewel-like. And then you had all these different other areas that were, you know, look like would, for lack of a better word, third world, you know, country. And so all of a sudden it was like you were transposed. You were like here, meaning in LA, but then you were somewhere else. You know, you were in this other world. And then different areas of this little location were just like full of textures and rusts and found objects. And I was really, really interested in art from found objects. So all of a sudden, this location became one big potential art piece. And so it was about our moving, you know, in it, you know, collaborating, but at the same time, you know, certain things I wanted her, you know, to do. And luckily, she was open enough, at least the first time. But when we had to go back, it was, you know, sort of like a dialogue that went, you know, that happened in terms of we're going to go back and do this, you know. And then so, you know, two friends had helped the first time. One was Peter Blue, one was Rojo, and the last time was Ben Caldwell. And, you know, I know Ben did not know what the hell he had gotten into. But at the same time, you know, he was very open to collaborating with the experience. And so, you know, so what it was about was taking a look at this space and creating another, you know, reformulating it and transforming it, you know, even farther into, you know, like this open air, site-specific even, that's what they would call it now, you know, like performance, And so that's kind of like what Water Ritual wound up being.
Yeah, Ritual in Transfigured Space, as Maya Deren used to talk about, you know, her work. It feels like a kind of a renewed notion of that way of thinking. Okay, well, thank you. Okay. I think it's probably a good moment to go to the film now.
Sure.
And then we'll continue afterwards.
Okay, now we're going to go to June's presentation, just because we're running a little bit behind time. But Barbara will be back in the second part to take part in the discussion and also take any questions about her remarkable work. So please join me now in welcoming June Giovanni.
Hi. Hi, I'm sorry, my voice is a little croaky. I'll just... Right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. And I must say that I'm very glad and very honoured to be here to be part of this whole event. There's some of the filmmakers and the films that I've known for years as a curator. And it's also an area that is present throughout the work that I've done over the years, because the archive that I'm in the process of setting up is based on those years of working as a curator of Pan-African cinema, black cinema, working with third cinema. So the presentation that I'm going to do this afternoon is based very much on the archive, which, as the name suggests, is related to those years of working. And it includes black British, African American, black cinema from Europe, African cinema, Caribbean cinema, and other related diaspora images, cinemas. So this is not an analytical presentation. I suppose you could describe it as more personal and anecdotal, but it has involved a number of occasions and events and exchanges which some of this influential and powerful group of filmmakers who were a defining influence in black independent cinema and Pan-African cinema have brought to us. So it's a presentation reflecting on the context and impact of the LA Rebellion films in the UK and internationally. It's not wholly, fully chronological, because, as I say, because it's based on the archive, it's based on the elements that I had been involved with and that I know about. And in fact, the archive is still in development, so even the archive itself is not totally represented in the materials that we're going to see here. But I suppose you could say it's going to be a sort of a chronological presentation of some of these moments and some of these places where the UCLA films that we know and are seeing in this program have been shown. So, but I'd like to first start with a few comments about the early connections and influence. The connection with the UK, with the films and filmmakers known as the LA Rebellion, go back a number of decades. And in that context, I was reminded by one of the UK filmmakers of that time, Imru Bukhari, who's here at the back there, that Colin Young was the chair of the School of Film and Theatre in 1965 at UCLA. And that's the same Colin Young who afterwards became the first director of the National Film School here in the UK. And it's a link that's not insignificant, because in this context, when we note that while at the UCLA, he started, well, whether he started it or whether the filmmakers started it, but it happened under his watch, the setting up of the ethnographic film program. And I think Zainabu's film, if it's here or if it's going to be shown, some of the filmmakers and some of Zainabu's commentary about the LA Rebellion mentions that time and that period. Theatre and the performing arts generally is an area of collaboration apparent at UCLA Film and Theatre School of the 1970s, while at the same time, here in the UK, there was a time of close collaboration between these art forms with significant links between black theatre and black film movement here in the 1970s. We had the Kiskadee Theatre Company, Temba, Talawa Theatre Companies, and we also had the Black Arts Movements, Black Arts Movement, etc., nurturing on-screen talent. So it's not surprising, then, that the three earliest black British filmmakers' first connection with film were as actors. We had Lloyd Record, who worked a lot in TV, in drama like You and Your Small Corner, Lionel Ngakane, who came from South Africa, with Zoltan Korda's Cry the Beloved Country, and Horace Ove, who worked as an extra on the Joseph Mankiewicz's Cleopatra. And these are some of the early black British filmmakers, and they came to film with this sort of connection. Horace Ove's own development in these early years was linked to the black arts movement, and his early film, Baldwin's Nigger, made in 1966, is an example of the cultural interface between the US and the UK around race generally at that time. And I just would like to mention the fact, I was thinking about it when we were talking earlier today, that this was also a time when there was so much interconnection with the US around issues of race, but also culturally, when the John LaRose and the George Padmore Institute and New Beacon had set up the Black and Third World Book Fair. It was a really vibrant time for black arts, and that was a major stage for the connection between what was happening here in the UK and in the US. Of course, France and Germany had a long history as well as location for artists and writers escaping the McCarthy era and stifling of black civil rights, creativity, and culture. From the aviator Bessie Coleman, James Baldwin, Robeson, Richard Wright, and many others. Right, yeah. Okay. More specifically, among some of the early connections between the UCLA filmmakers and black filmmakers in Europe was the Independent Black American Cinema Festival in Paris in 1981, and present were stalwarts of black independent cinema in its archival history. Pearl Bowser of Third World Newsreel, who put this particular program, program booklet together. And there were filmmakers like from the East Coast as well, Warrington Hudlin from the Black Filmmaker Foundation, other filmmakers, Bill Gunn, Bill Greaves, Kathy Collins, and UCLA filmmakers. It was a vibrant time because this particular festival also provided an opportunity for filmmakers coming from North America to interact and interconnect with African filmmakers who were also showing their work at this particular festival. This is the middle page of that program. And you can see there's Ben Caldwell on the left. There's Larry Clark, I think, in the middle. Charles Burnett at the bottom. And it was very much noted, and it was very much celebrated, this moment, within the French experience and connection with African-American cinema. In the UK, two major events consolidated links between filmmakers on a global scale. engaging with each other's films and by prioritizing issues of production, finance, distribution in the discussions that they had. So in the UK, we met. They met with the black filmmaking community at the first Black Film Festival in 1982, a year after the London riots. This festival was organized by the event curator Jim Pines with Perminder Veer, the arts officer at the Commonwealth Institute, where they both worked. Jim before moving to the BFI, and while Perminder went to work at the GLC. So this was a year after the London riots, and remembering the significance, I'm not sure if it's a significant thing, maybe it's a question, but it did strike me that the development around this very strident cinema in UCLA, at UCLA in LA, also took place after an important time within that city's history, naming the Watts riots. I'm not sure if I'm making a spurious connection there, but it was a time of people choosing to take forward this independence and to represent themselves in a much clearer way and with a much clearer ambition. Jim Pines recalls that the filmmakers that came to this particular event were Robert Gardner, Charles Burnett, Julie Dash, Roy Campanella Jr., Warrington Hudlin, Mabuko Daikite, and Ayoka Chenzira. So you had both North Coast and East Coast. He thinks that Ben Caldwell also came, and Sharon Larkin and Monica Freeman might have been there also. I went to see some of the films, but I hadn't seen all of the filmmakers. This event provided opportunities for the young UK filmmakers beginning to work collectively and forming themselves into workshops under the ACTT workshop agreement, and the black independent filmmakers and companies to engage with the LA filmmakers and their work, and the lifelong connections were begun. The collective approach of working, seeking any opportunities for transatlantic collaborations and showcasing, some of which I'll mention in a while. In the early 19, this is the program of that, the Commonwealth Black Film Festival, 1982. In the early 1980s, independent cinema movement was heightened on both sides of the Atlantic, a movement challenging both politically and aesthetically mainstream cinema traditions, which embraced various cultural and class backgrounds and influences. Black independent filmmakers, both in the USA and Europe, found resonance in the international movements such as Third Cinema and Pan-Africanism. A faculty member and student at UCLA School of Theatre, Film and Television in the 1970s and early 1980s, Tashomi Gabriel, was both a colleague and a mentor to many of the filmmakers in this movement, and his work charted what was described at the time as a genuinely new theory of black cinema. Gabriel's influential essays were Third Cinema in the Third World, The Aesthetics of Liberation, and the 1990 essay, Nomadic Aesthetic and Black Independent Cinema. The principle of Third Cinema was described by Gabriel in this context as, it's not so much where a film is made or even who makes it, but rather the ideology it espouses. The Third Cinema is that cinema of the Third World which stands opposed to imperialism and class oppression in all their ramifications and manifestations. There were times when, much later in the 80s, when this was challenged at the Third Cinema Conference that took place in Edinburgh in 86, and Paul Willimon, who worked at the BFI and a theorist, actually took issue with a number of of Tshomi Gabriel's ideas. But we'll come back to Tshomi a bit later. But that expanded idea of third cinema in 1982 and 83 was explored at London's Third Eye Film Festival and Symposium, organised by Perminda Veer and curated by myself at the GLC with an advisory group of filmmakers including Lionel Engakani, Imru Bukhari, H.O. Nazareth, Mike Phillips, Prabhu Guptara and S.C. Peglo. African-American filmmakers alongside African-Indian, Latin American, Caribbean and Black British filmmakers and theorists participated in a two-week festival, including a one-week symposium at the Ritzy Cinema, the Rio Cinema, and Bloomsbury Theatre. UCLA filmmakers and films included were Illusions by Julie Dash, Harvest 3,000 Years by Hailey, My Brother's Wedding from Charles Burnett. I think at that time, Killer of Sheep had already shown here, and the BFI were acquiring that. But My Brother's Wedding was his second feature in that context. Grey Area by Manona Wally, but there were other films including Bill Gunn's Ganja and Hess, Reggie Hudlin's House Party, The Prototype. He was only 18 years old, and this was a little film that he was just working on at college. Kathleen Collins, Losing Ground, alongside the UK films of Horace Ove, Colin Prescott, Salman Pirzada, Aman Sabasakana, H.O. Nazareth, Henry Martin, Suleika Nath, and many others, and an early film from Mira Nair, and many more. Seeing each other's films and discussing them with London audiences and Birmingham to some extent via Vakani, with the screenings organised by Pervez Khan. This is the brochure that documented the whole symposium. And part one of this brochure is based on the presentations and discussions that took place in the seminar in 1983. And that includes Manona Wally's contribution on the women, on representation of women in third cinema panel. Haile Gerima also spoke about African-American cinema, and Clyde Taylor was one of the theorists who coined the phrase LA Rebellion, recognizing a movement in 1986. That's 3 years after this festival also spoke. And these are some of the images of... Sorry, that's the contents of the two events. The second one I'll talk about in a minute. And these are some of the images of that conference. To the far left is Haile Gerima. Next to him is Shyam Benegal. Around the table, Perminda Veer. Next to her, H.O. Nazareth. But in the background, there's some interesting people. There's Albert Bailey, who was the sound engineer on a little film that Kumba were making at the time of the conference. And for the UK people, there's Pat Murphy, who owns the Ritzy, sitting at the back on the left. And next to him, Penny, who was working for, I think it was Pictures of Women or Cinema of Women, one of the feminist distributors. The event really pulled a lot of people together who were interested in independent cinema, who were interested in third cinema, and they were there in this discussion with all of these people from various continents. In the lower picture, we see Manona Wally next to Philippe Jalado from the Three Continents Film Festival in France, both here at the Third Eye Festival. here, Haile, and next to Haile is Prema Karan, the Indian filmmaker whose film Panyama opened that festival. And the image on the front of the Third Eye booklet I just showed you is from her film. And the picture below has Clyde Taylor speaking in the middle of that picture. And to his left, Bill Gunn, who's sort of sitting back, and Segun Oyekunle, who was also a UCLA graduate and who spoke as well at Third Eye. And to the right of the table, the Chilean director Miguel Litin, who was also a speaker, and next to him, Jose Masip from Cuba. This is a chilling spot. I did say some of it was going to be anecdotal. And below, Haile with Kwa Ansah, the Ghanaian filmmaker. This is Warrington Hudlin. And there we have, Reggie. It's Reggie. Reggie Hudlin. And just behind him, we've got Seleka Nath and Stella Diego, I think. Yeah, Stella Diego to the left. Because they were also on the women's panel with people like Martina Atiel, Maureen Blackwood, Nadine Marsh-Edwards. I mean, you know, everybody was there. So it was a real rich moment for these sort of exchanges. Okay, now following on from the seminar, a further conference was organized by the GLC at the National Film Theatre in 1984, chaired by Colin Prescott, and featuring black film workshops and production companies entitled The Black Film Sector, Which Way Forward? And that was quite interesting because coming out of the Third Eye conference, there was this moment to reflect on what, you know, what was going to happen here in the UK. And this was it was sort of part two of Third Eye, another conference looking specifically at what was happening here in the UK. The Black Film Sector, Which Way Forward, with presentations by Riesel Gust from the Black Audio Film Collective, Menelik Shabazz from Kumba Productions, Isaac Julian from Sankofa, H.O. Nazareth, from Penumbra Productions, Mahmoud Jamal for Retake, Raj Patel, Ujjaybe for Chedo, Claudine Booth, and Pamin Devere. And this is the end of that particular conference, and the picture is taken at the National Film Theatre, and you see on the left Avril Johnson from Black Audio next to John. I think Eddie George is hiding in between there. Then there's Isaac Julian, and at the end, seated, is Diane Abbott, who was very active in media at that time. She, for those of you who are not from here, might not know, but she was one of the first black MPs to enter the House of Commons. And in fact, we were part of a group called Black Media Workers in the late 70s. Here, and she was part of that. And standing, you have Prabhu Guptara, I think that's Raj Patel, and some others. And sitting on this side, Pamin Devere, seated right at the far end, me peeking over the top. And I think it's Karen Alexander and some others. Anyway, this was a moment when the impact of that Third Eye conference was discussed in the UK in terms of the way forward for here. And that involved looking at what was happening at Channel 4, what it was doing and how it was supporting independent cinema, and also looking at how the various structures for the support of cinema could help. Moving swiftly on to Africa. Before we do that, there was a film that Kumba Productions was making about Third Eye, and courtesy of Kumba Productions, I have, the film was never completed. It was a, so it's still regarded as a work in progress. But there is, I'm going to show you just a 2-minute clip, which is the intro sequence, so you can see a few of the people who spoke about that. So we're going to look at that now. Okay, all right. Thanks. Well, I'm going to have to move on pretty quickly because we're all running a little behind time. So I'll just go quickly over this part, which is in Algeria. And Billy will remember this because he was one of the people who was present. So on the African continent, this was one of the moments where filmmakers, again, from Asia, from the African continent, from the African diaspora, met together. I remember it as the 20th anniversary of the Black Arts Festival that took place in Algeria at a time when the Panthers and there was very much an African-American presence. And this was a film festival that was part of a bigger celebration of that moment, and it was happening in 89. Haile was there. He was in the process of making Sankofa and was going through some really terrible and tough times. I remember we had a conversation about it. But Lionel Ngakane, South African director in the front, kept us all laughing and bubbling. We had Myrnal Sen, very statesmanlike, and who told the bluest jokes. And many others. On the lower picture, we have Larry Clark to the left and Haile Gerima. I think, I don't know the guy in between Haile Gerima and Billy. But this guy is Azzedine Mabruki, who had organized that particular event. Very quickly, this is FESPACO, and FESPACO was significant for Africa and African cinema and the African diaspora. And this, I mentioned this because Haile was one of the architects of that relationship for the diaspora with African cinema, because he had one foot in both camps. He was both from the diaspora and he was also an African filmmaker. He was an African person. And he was one of the people that helped to bring into being, in terms of cinema, at the time of Thomas Sankara, this ambition that the continent had through the AU, eventually, to recognize an African diaspora. And this was a meeting of a lot of the diaspora people there when we were setting up the Robeson Prize for the best African diaspora film. And you see a range of people, Claire Watkins from Boston. There's Nadine Marsh Edwards, who's at the back there, trying to hide, from Sankofa. Pearl Bowser, Hal Weaver, Mbai Cham, and many others. And Haile, you will see, I'll have to move on pretty fast. At the top picture is Haile with Med Hondo and Ai Keita, the actress who played Queen Sarunia. And just to his right, two people to his right, is Dahar Sharia. He's like the Sem Ben of Tunisian cinema. He is one of the people who helped to set up the Pan-African Filmmakers Federation and this major festival as well here, and the one in Tunis. And below, again, it's the diaspora. This is now the Caribbean. And the thing is, the Havana Film Festival in the 80s actually had a very big ambition to bring together independent filmmakers through the various filmmaker institution that existed. And in the top one, we see Larry Clark, and that's myself in the middle, and filmmaker Carmen Cousteau trying to take a picture as I rest my eyes. but it was a time that they were actually trying to see whether the continents could bypass the bigger and wider markets so that there could be collaboration around production, but also around distribution. And that was one of the conferences that was discussing that. Below is I think it's a different year, but again, it's the early 80s, with Haile, I'd call this a little diaspora triangle. It's Haile Gerima, Sergio Hirao, the director in the middle, who made the trilogy of films about slavery in Cuba, and Philippe Sawadogo, very young Philippe Sawadogo, who had just been brought on under Sankara's time to set up or to expand the FESPACO Film Festival. This is Martinique, of course, the Caribbean Film Festival. There's Julie and some other of the African-American contingent. Charles was there. Behind Julie is Isaac Julian and many others. I'm sorry, I'm trying to rush through. Back to a few of the UK examples of the work. This was a program with a feminist distributor that we did that involved Julie's work. Julie and Ioka was just around their work. And I'll skip over these. Film and video lists that I'd composed, had put together for the BFI, indicating what films were in distribution in the UK at that time, and that was the late 80s. This was something that myself and Bernice Renault did for the Créteil Film Festival, and it was a big programme at Créteil, the Women's Film Festival, and I can't remember when that was, 1989. It was quite a presence, again, across a sort of Pan-African presence of films and of filmmakers. So you could see for the UCLA presence, there were people like Sandra Sharp, there encased by Ozan Palsy, and the UK's Ngozi Onwuara. There's Zainabu, there's Martina Atil, Safi Fay, Michelle at the top, a young Cassie Lemons, Julie's Four Women, Ioka at the bottom. I only chose a few pages. It was a big catalogue. We had 28 films, and it was a very big presence as well, because we also had... Angela Davis was the iconic special guest for the discussion event at that event in Créteil. And as you know, she was a UCLA professor and had a direct link with the LA Rebellion group in that film that Haile made of Child of Resistance was inspired by a dream. After having seen Angela Davis handcuffed on television, she was very supportive at that event and brought another dimension to the whole discussion, and to especially to the whole discussion of Pan-African cinema and the women, the role of women in it. Let's see. I did have the Black Film Bulletins. Sorry, can I go back? Yeah, in this issue, which you can find on my website, actually, there was a long interview with Haile, and it's called Decolonizing Film, where he talks about his aesthetics and what he does. And so you can see that particular interview in that issue. And in this one, there were two interviews that I'd done, one with Charles Burnett about the glass shield. And these two I will put on the website sometime in the next couple of weeks while this program is running. And this one on A.J. Fielder, the cinematographer, who worked not only with Julie Dash, but also with John Acumphra. He shot Seven Songs, he shot Daughters of the Dust, and he shot Spike Lee's Crooklyn. And he was somebody, as you can see at the top it says, he was one of the students of Haile Gerima at Howard. So the Blackfern Bulletin was the magazine that Gaylene Gould and I started at the BFI. This was around the time that Black Film Review was on a wane, but it was also at the time when we were continually being bombarded for information about what was happening in black film. And so we did this bulletin from the African Caribbean unit at the BFI. So there's information about that on the... And the particular interview that I did with AJ was edited and presented in this form by Kojo Eshin. So thank you, Kojo. This is just anecdotal. It's the girls meeting up with Julie. Whenever anybody comes through, we'd meet up. There's Maureen Blackwood, there's Julie, Nadine, me, and Karen Alexander. Quick. And this is the third... Third World Film Festival in Atlanta that was organized annually by a woman called Cheryl Chisholm. And on this occasion, we had a sort of a panel with Horace Ove, as you can see from this end, Claire Prieto from Canada, Julie at the other end, discussing the diaspora cinema in that. It's another picture of them. Now, in 1995, Africa 95 was a big national arts festival here. And within it, I was at the BFI. I did about 11 different programs under this title of Screen Griots. And it was actually bringing together... And the Screen Griots program included a Haile Gerima season, which and he came over and presented that. But it also we also did a sight and sound special supplement called African Conversations, where Haile did an analysis, a screen by screen analysis, or a selection of slides analysis that we put in the center of that sight and sound supplement, and it was called Visions of Resistance. It was based on his film, Harvest 3,000 Years, which is my favourite of his films. At that event, at that time, part of Screen Griots was this major conference. It was called Africa and the History of Cinematic Ideas, quite a heavy title, but it brought together... artists and filmmakers and critics from everywhere, from Europe, from America, and from the UK. It was quite a big event, and these are a few of the images. We were lucky because before this, Toshomi Gabriel had been invited so many times, and this was one of the few occasions that he was able to come and participate. So it's Toshomi at the top there, and that's him with the Tunisian director, Nouri Bouzid. And the discussion was around specific areas to do with the development of African cinema and its role in a wider context in other cinemas. The keynote speech was given by Sylvia Winter. At the top there is Haile Gerima with Idrissa Ouedraogo, the Burkinabe filmmaker. And in the bottom, Haile is discussing with Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who has his back to us, and by Cham from Howard at the left, Lionel, and this guy's a dancer, H. Patton. Again, we've got Clyde Taylor with Roy at the top with Yabba Bajo and with Roy Arms. And I love this picture because it has so much of Africa and the diaspora. Pedro Pimenta from Mozambique, having a laugh with Gaston Kabore, one of the stalwarts of African cinema from Burkina, Haile, and Susie Lando, who directed the Image Caribe Film Festival over the 6 years that it existed in the late 80s. And actually, things like these gatherings were also really significant for bringing us all together. In Fisbaco, that's where I met Susie and started working with Imash Karib. And that's where all this connection took place. Moving swiftly on, trying to get to the end. This is a very recent photograph, and this is Julie. I do program for a festival in Kerala, in India, called the International Film Festival of Kerala. And I program African cinema there, or Pan-African cinema, and usually recommending films for the competition, feature films, but also doing a curated program. And in 2010, the curated program I did was around the LA Rebellion, but this was before the films were all gathered. And when I did contact UCLA, they told me that they had this process ongoing to redevelop, you know, to restore and present the films as a package. But this was just a small presentation of the work of Julie, Haile, Billy, and Charles, and yeah, Julie, Haile, Billy, and Charles. I think that was, oh, and Larry Clark. And this is Julie. Julie ended up being on the jury, and this is her presenting her work. And I think the next one is us talking about it. It was called The Spirit of Independence. A Black American film or something like that, I think it was called at that point. But it was a great platform, because this was, I mean, just a little bit about Kerala. It's a state-run festival in a socialist state that's very, very cine-literate, the highest literacy generally within India. And it had been run for a number of years, they, you know, with a very, very, with a very, quite an expansive agenda from the 90s going forward, because they had, when I first started working with them, most of their external films were coming from Eastern Bloc countries, but the expansion that they consciously made was to engage with other continents as well, and the main prizes are for African and Asian and Latin American films. And I'm rushing, so I've forgotten a lot of things that I wanted to say, but we'll, you know, most probably pick up on them in the next thing. But this was 2010, so this was the last of the recent events. So sorry, I hope I haven't bored you too long with that, but we can put some meat on that when we have the discussion. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, thank you, June, for incredible encapsulation of such a rich and complex and multifaceted history. Please join us now. We have coffee and tea outside in the kind of foyer area. You can go through this door at the edge here, or the one at the back, and we'll reconvene in here at... We'll try get back at about 4:05, so around 15... We'll have about 15-minute break, and then we'll get going with the second session. Thank you. Oh, let's... Sorry, let's... Let's reconvene at 4:15.